I'm sure that Sean and Aruna join me in expressing our thoughts and prayers for the improving health of Dr. Toinette Eugene, who could not be with us today. And we're particularly grateful to Sean for joining us on such short notice. As Jean Audrey said, this is homecoming for me. I sit here in the audience and see my high school classmates' daughters who are pastors of churches. I seem to have started a movement in the First Presbyterian Church of Laverne, Minnesota, which has had a wonderful fulfillment in First Methodist Church, too. And it is wonderful to be here. And it is profoundly moving because when this conference was first imagined, it was my college friend Sally Hill who called to say some years ago, some of us are thinking about doing a conference on feminist theology. And we began to talk. I hardly expected anything so rich, so surprisingly complicated, so wonderfully full of the possibilities of human imagination as this event. When I was in Central Africa, in Zimbabwe, a year ago last January, at a theological conference which five of us, with the women in the U.S. group, threatened to boycott if they didn't find some African feminist theologians for us to hear. They did locate two. And they located them in the library and in the part-time teaching faculty. And they had never heard them lecture before, and they were the finest of lecturers we heard. One of them said, "It is the task of women to reimage our lives under the image of abundant life, to fundamentally reject the economy of scarcity as anything we will settle for in the economy of life, the ecology of life." This conference reminds me how far we have come, we women in the church, and how much we have managed to resist efforts to rob us of our dreams, our hopes, our truths. At the same time, though I have loved being in this space free for imagination, because it is so rare to be in such a space, and we are punished so much for speaking of the deepest desires and longings of our hearts, even so, something bothered me until today. Now, I must admit, on the first day of the conference, it came to me. How in God's name should we start theological reflection talking first about reimaging God and then reimaging Jesus, and only on the third day come to talking about ethics, work, and ministry, the practice of the Christian life? The fact is that all theologies of transformation which have taken hold from below in Christian communities around the globe and in some other religious traditions below as well, all of these theologies make an assumption, which is that theological reflection is only safe, it is brain damaging, if you start from the assumptions on the top. If you start with assuming that you can name and reimage God, until and unless you have looked at the concrete historical praxis in which you are set, it is the work, I submit, of ethics, of practical theology, of the economic analysis of our society to start in the concrete. And the issue always is the issue we heard about this morning. What community do you desire? Who have you come from, and with whom do you cast your lot? Where are you headed, and with whom do you want to go? As the great lesbian feminist theologian Adrienne Rich has said, these are the basic theological questions of life. And so it is dangerous to put the cart before the horse, because theology is the second act. Bernice Reagan, Johnson Reagan, said it very clearly. Be careful of spirituality unless it arises from the storm. And know that the struggles of our present time are producing very different forms of spirituality, and much of it is dangerous and has nothing to do with abundant life. Interestingly enough, even those ancient ethicists, Plato and Aristotle, were aware of some of these issues that I have just suggested. I've never regretted having to learn the male tradition. I only regret having to had to learn it without the freedom of my own deepest questions out there on the table. It was Plato who the great contemplationist, the great spiritualizer of the Western tradition, who imaged the life of ethics as discernment of the deepest, unchanging, rational laws of the universe. He began with spirituality, and the wisdom of his spirituality told him that the philosopher could discern, and the moral reason of the philosopher would give us those unchanging laws, which, if we obeyed them, we would be good people, exemplary of our species. Aristotle disagreed. In my opinion, he improved the situation slightly. Ethics, he said, arises out of politics, not out of spirituality. Ethics, he said, are the effort to decide on what kind of community we want to be and what kind of human persons we want to be. This is why he spent so much time talking about virtue. Virtue is what makes the good person. But of course, it also means to be the exemplary man. It's what virtue meant in our tradition. Now, the efforts of those in Christianity from below, and others from below, to reformulate theological imagination have also had to take the form of reformulating our basic understandings of what the moral life is all about. It's not a total revolution, in my opinion, but it is a revolution which insists upon certain shifts which are quite new to Christianity. Particularly, please get that, particularly in its Western forms. But it is the Western form that has pushed itself to colonize the globe and produce many forms of Christianity of which we have heard complaint at this conference. That tradition assumes that ethics is about obedience to goods we already know, rather than, and here's where it's so important to keep politics in the picture, rather than the struggle to reformulate the wisdoms of your traditions when you meet other traditions. Ethics is about the process of testing the traditions in order that a polis, a shared community of divergent traditions, may emerge. And so we must understand, all of us, that the task that we face in reimagining ethics is the task of helping persons in our churches understand that we do not move from pre-formulated theological answers, which we imprint in the brains of obedient laity and clergy, casting out those who won't obey, but rather that it is about the struggle to save what deserves saving in our traditions, bringing them alive by reinterpretation in the encounter with the values, virtues, and obligations of other people, of those who have a different ethos, a different mores than ourselves. We live in a time where the most important work of community building is to find, to be a people of faith who are really good at this struggle, this moral struggle. And we live at a time where what I now call the old line, I'm old line, Presbyterian of Lutheran roots, that makes as old line as you can get. I mean by that the Reformation, the churches that go back to the European Reformation. The old line Christians, who are well represented here, in addition to myself, are speaking in a situation where the leadership of the churches doesn't in any way understand the historic positioning of the community of faith which we represent. And because there are so many of us, I want to talk a little bit about this positioning. Now, Christians, like all people who love their community and their traditions, or who find any real value in them, will be, when we live off by ourselves and are largely look alike, act alike, etc., etc., under those conditions, we will be traditionalists. We will value our traditions. We may be quite defensive about them. If we hear somebody criticize them, we're likely to get very upset. Traditionalism in religion is simply the product, it's certainly the product of being the majority. The people who are minority in terms of religious sense never can be quite traditionalist because they know they don't have the only voice. This is why the Asian women have had such a powerful influence here, because they are such a tiny minority in their cultures. But churches can be traditionalist, and they are. And in traditionalism, the tradition itself is viewed as sacred and holy in a highly uncritical way, and for reasons that we modern Western secularized people don't understand at all. For example, the Bible is honored, but it is honored as a book from which you preach oral tradition. It is the oracular character of the preaching from the text which ties you to your community. Many who revere the Bible in these circumstances have never read it, but they hear it preached all the time, and they remember from these stories who they are. They get their subversive memory, if there is any subversive memory in their living, in their traditions, that is if they're alive. They get it from this. Now, traditionalists are not in any way a negative force spiritually in the world until the crisis comes. Now, what's a crisis? Well, it's any major turning where power realigns itself in history. Any major turning where power realigns itself in history. And when the crisis comes, as the great poet Yeats said, the center does not hold. And you must decide whether to go forward or whether to go backwards, or rather to keep what is in place. And so traditionalist religions of all sort are contested terrains of ideological warfare in our world, and for good reason. And in our world, there is a new and modern version of Christianity. Please note, new and modern, called fundamentalism. They say they are literal about the Bible. Hyung Kyung said she wanted to be literal in some ways, and I'm surprised she doesn't remember, as we've talked about this before, I always say to her, well, of course we want to be literal. The point is to make our dreams and visions of God literal. But we're not there yet. This notion of biblical literalism, of course, you couldn't possibly observe if you hadn't adopted the historical critical method of the liberal theological story in the West. But those liberals who began to seek critical ways of reinterpreting their past have lost their nerve. And they believe the fundamentalists have really got the truth, and they long so much, some of these leaders of liberalism, for a master narrative to reimpose upon the rest of us, that they are leading us into moral sewers we may not find our way out of for a very long time. And all of this in the name of a restored and lofty concern for Christian virtue and Christian obligation. Nonsense. The work of theology is, as Bernice Johnson Reagan reminded us, in the struggle. Its touchstone is power and reconfiguring and reimagining power, and also exposing its abuse. To be at the heart of the struggle of good and evil as it affects the lives of people concretely in our time. That is the stance, and from there, our theological reimaginings will be wonderful, and that's what all these feminist, wonderful feminist theologians have been doing. But if they didn't bring the right theologians here and we used the wrong method, we would have been in the soup. Happily, we are not. That, then, is our situation. I told her to give me 10 minutes, and isn't this lucky? I'm just getting started. I was very worried, you see, because they didn't exactly tell us what division of labor to use, but the Spirit's been at work, so we've already had our theology of ministry revision. We've already talked about this urgent, embodied issue of what life is like when your work alienates you from yourself at the deepest, deepest level. So I don't have to talk about that. I'll just say a few more things about the tasks of moral reconstructions. Feminist, womanist, mujerista ethicists have done remarkable re-envisioning of ethics. We have done many things, including the discovery that the church as a moral community and the churches as moral teachers are more affected by our actions, our rituals, by our total environment, about how we use the space, what we do with the parking lot. I haven't heard anybody discuss the ethics of destroying grass to build parking lots, but that we've got to drive the whole discussion to that point. We have done a very good job, but we still have a long way to go. The other things we have done is we have revisioned Christian norms for action from the voices of women to a large extent. Now, not all of this has been tough enough or deep enough. For a while, white feminist ethicists like myself were stumbling around, and there's still some stumbling, trying to suggest that we could get our ethics out of caring because women are caretakers and justice was suspect. It fell to me to tell Carol Gilligan, Carol changed her views entirely, but it fell to me at a conference at Harvard once, in order to restore discussion between the 100 women from the rest of the world and the 100 U.S. women, to explain to her that she was using a liberal capitalist theory of justice, and that there was one in her scriptures, since she's Jewish, which is much better, and to suggest that she wouldn't have to see these things in opposition, if she would understand that she learned her ethics at a liberal Protestant seminary, and that was a disastrous mistake because she learned that love was more important than justice, a mistake which Protestants in late capitalism have taken as gospel, which is the road to death. We've gone a long way, and we have gone a long way in revisioning a total understanding of what moral conflict and moral dilemma is all about, but we've got a long way to go. And we've discovered, and this is very important, that not only do we have to put new dilemmas on the agenda, the world is changing so fast that we, for example, have to start talking about the morality of our relationship to animals when we haven't even got a half-decent morality in place in terms of our relationships to each other. We have to talk about reproductive technologies while the leaders of the sanctimonious leaders of the churches are telling us that every woman who resorts to an abortion is a murderer. We have to worry about sterilization abuse as the chief available birth control method of women on this globe, largely because what religious leaders do. We have begun the work. We have learned, I think, to find some points of commonality. We are struggling, and we haven't gone nearly as far as we must, to understand how to theorize the praxis of our lives in ways that make it clear to each of us, whoever we are, that racism is a structure of violence, that poverty created poverty, and believe me, it's created. Anybody who says it's part of the natural order, forgive me. It is a structure of violence, a historical practices built up over time which can and must be undone. And we have learned to put discourse about sexuality on our agenda so that we may talk about the patterns of intimate violence and face-to-face harassment and control, and we may also talk about state-sponsored programs of the sale and use of women's bodies, which now have unparalleled force in our world. Women are, in many countries, the chief source of dollars for capital. And we are learning, I think, to revision our faith, our religious faith, as a call to wholeness, to health. And as, was it you, Aruna, or perhaps Mercy, said this morning, health is the release from bondage. We have begun to see the work of feminist ethics this way. We have even begun to hope for a world in which we will experience the eroticization of equality, as human beings have been taught for eons and centuries to get turned on by inequality. So we have our work cut off for us, but we are on the way. What we need to know and believe, all of us who come from local communities, and I'm so mindful of how many of you are laywomen and how many of you are pastors, and I know you've come, so many have said, I needed this. The road is hard, and we need at conferences like this to talk about what it means to sustain this kind of work of ministry over time. In the face of a great deal of church abuse. When we start talking about the institution of the church and its abuse of women and get those points across, we will have come much further. This is only a beginning. But I believe in my heart of hearts, not because women are caretakers only. We do all the work and do all the caring. I mean, it is a very big mistake to imagine that women don't do all the work. The last UN Decade of Women said we do not 66%, as Lois said this morning, but one report said 90%. And then when attacked, they dropped it to 80% of the human labor hours done on this planet. Because most of it is unpaid, the wage-labor relation is now disappearing from the world, as Sean suggested, disappearing from the world. But the wage-labor relation went chiefly to men, although not in the first wave. It was first women, and then they were returned. They were pushed out. But most of the world now, of course, it is still women who are the first wave. Look at the factories on the Mexican border and who works there. But we do all of the work. And our bodies are broken, our hearts are broken, and Now, in this world, 60% of all the children are dependent on women alone, and that figure is growing. So let no one challenge us or make us feel like we are doing special pleading for women. This is about humanity. It's about the human community. It is about the possibility of the life of the human community. And to leave any of this out of the agenda of the church and its ministry is to turn back, not, as the fundamentalists claim, to the origins of the Christian community. They wouldn't know it if they saw it. Fundamentalism isn't about saving the past. It's about creating a virtual reality. You know, the new communication theory where you build something that looks like it has reality, but it's all phony. This is not literalism. This is the effort to convince us through the use of fear and alienation that we can live without our lives, and that the few of us who have the remnants of a life still to live ought to join them in taking the lives away from others. And so this is our situation. And the work of feminist ethics is just more exciting than you would believe. 40 of us, see, several of my friends who were there met at Andover Newton Seminary. We have a once a year women's self-help group. Sean, we want you to come. For both activists and academics of all levels who are interested in ethics. And when we meet, I learn more about ethics, about issues, about society and the world in those 36 hours. Then I learn on a theological faculty of really pretty good people. And it's the best one, in my opinion, in the world. And by the way, I don't apologize for the brain damage you've been exposed to from my seminary at this conference. But this group of women, for example, we had three working on, we call it health ethics. We don't call it biomedical ethics because we want to get it away from the doctors. But we call it healthcare ethics. And we asked three of them to do a presentation for us. And in a couple of hours, they explained how bad the Clinton plan was, how much worse it would probably get if we didn't get in there in the fight. Started out by saying this is the way we would do it, but of course they won't do it that way, and laid it all out. And then we started talking about how the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, one of our numbers writing a book on this, is going to impose the U.S. health care plan, make it a condition of loans and capital in all the rest of the world, and wipe out all the health care systems that came into being in the anti-colonial period in the third world. I believe she's right, and I believe that we will be there explaining that, and hardly anybody else is. And the work, as it's related to communities of believers, is to see that to become a moral community is to become a community of people at the grassroots who can not only ourselves face the real dilemmas of our lives, all those lies, secrets, and silences about alcoholism, abuse, about all of the things that never, and the economic suffering of people. You know, the two things you can't talk about in church are sex and money, and everybody is dying of the failure to speak. We also have to forge a discourse on race and class, which persons who have been taught to keep silence under the rubric of liberal anti-racism, we must break that silence. What we are about, and it is the most exciting challenge in the world. And I promise you that there are secular people out there who never, never expect anything from Christians, who will say, oh my God, of course, we'll join you. And ministry will make sense when we have a doctrine of ministry which understands that a healthy community, be it a local congregation, is only alive if it has a healthy relation to its community, which means a real relation of tough love and criticism, but also work of solidarity in the pursuit of justice. The church, we feminists insist, lives for the sake of the world. To hold up before the world the sign of the blessing of God. Persons ourselves often broken, not yet healed, for we cannot be healed alone. There is no such thing as healing alone. But persons who will reach out, will move, will try, will engage, and who will stand with all our justice-loving friends and learn from them what keeps them in the struggle. Hear their testimonies of faith and unapologetically make our testimonies too. Is the new model of the ecumenical church are Christians who look for those who are in the storm and resisting evil and struggling for survival, and joining with them and saying, what can we teach each other about the meaning of faith and the image of God? I thank you.